Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Keith Lau, top international development authority and founder, Parametrics Ventures, Incorporated. Keith, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Thanks for having me here, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Keith, you have this fantastic background, so I want to sort of delve into some of the earlier parts of your career. For example, what led to your interest in computing and business, resulting in an honors degree in computer engineering and a minor in business management from the University of Waterloo?
Well, Stephen, when I was a kid, I always had a curiosity about how things work. You know, I could get hooked on the electronic project since I was a kid. And, you know, to be really honest with you, I try to take a lot of things apart and see what they're made of and what makes them work. When I went into high school, I got my first computer. And immediately, I got hooked into computer programming. I started with BASIC and then moved on with Pascal and you know, the C language. And I really got into this whole creativity thing with computers. One thing I really liked about computers is that it lets me realize my imagination, my ideas, without having to physically build something. So I can write programs to do things, to display things on the screen, and to interact with other people. And I think that's really very cool. So one really cool thing about computers, especially software, is that you're not limited by physical resources, such as hardware, you know, where any new product you need to build a fab. So that kind of gives you the idea of leveling the playing field between the haves and have-nots and, you know, for small startups. A little bit of background, I actually spent some of my formative years in Hong Kong, and then I went to high school. But in grade 10, I made a really interesting realization is that I decided that I wanted to go to Waterloo for computer engineering because it was back then one of the really top programs for doing that. And after I graduated, I had this crazy idea that I wanted to work for Microsoft. And that was all in grade 10. So basically what I did after that was really follow what I wanted to do. So when I came to Canada, I successfully got into Microsoft, Waterloo Computer Engineering. And one thing I realized while I was at school and preparing for the university education is that I realized that a combination of tech expertise and business savvy can really open a lot of doors down the road, like myself. So, you know, basically that's how I got into computer engineering and also took a minor in business management.
Well, you know, that's an interesting combination of the technical aspects and the business aspects. And I still find that when I'm talking with some IT folks that they don't necessarily see that connection of the value on the business side as much. But I noticed you made it part of your career, you know, starting from a very early age. So do you see this continue to build out, that sort of business connection?
Oh, absolutely, Stephen. If you really look at it about 5 years ago, maybe, there was this huge wave of people who were having engineering degrees and also pursuing MBAs. I mean, I'm sure you personally know a few of these people yourself. So that connection is very much there, and it's absolutely still here. And I think it will continue to grow because in a recent poll I read in one of the startup periodical magazines I read is that more and more younger people, in fact, a recent survey says about 50% of the Generation Y people who are currently in school dream of having their own business as opposed to going to work for a corporation. So I think the technical plus business savvy aspect will very much still be there in the future.
I mean, looking over your background, I just find this amazing that you were chosen to be part of an incubation team tasked with starting a new Microsoft Research and Development Center in Shanghai, China. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it came with, it was a total surprise for me. I wasn't really looking, and I stumbled upon the opportunity. I came across a posting from the startup person of that team, who wants to hire a couple people to go with him to relocate to China and actually start this thing. So I spoke with him, and then, you know, we seemed to build a rapport. And I think three things really set me up for this job, which is my personality and skill sets that I had at that time, and it was the timing that really made everything happen. To delve into that a little bit more, you know, as you can see from my background, I really have a penchant for startups. You know, I worked at the Xbox Live launch team. And a little trivia that you didn't know is that even when I was back in university, you know, I started a little company with a friend who was doing point of sale systems for Chinese restaurants. So, you know, I always had this element that I want to, you know, be involved in startups and see how things pan out. So in terms of personality, I think the hiring manager thought that, you know, I would have the integrity, so to speak, to be successful in China without, you know, having any major compromise with the company, and my relatively deep and broad technical skills to, you know, evaluate technical talent really helped me to be a key contributor to that particular situation. And I also have, you know, decent interpersonal skills that allows me to deal with the various levels of business contacts in China and back in Redmond as well. So another thing that I think might have helped me was, I think, language-wise, because in terms of speaking, I'm pretty much native in English and Cantonese. I can read and write traditional simplified Chinese. But one thing that really helped me back was I didn't know how to speak Mandarin well or almost at all. So they took a chance on me, and then I picked it up during some early training. And when I actually landed in China soil, it took me a couple months to really ramp up, but I'm glad to say that now I can speak Mandarin, so that's a big plus for me. So in terms of timing, I was actually at the juncture where I was considering leaving the company after, you know, shipping Xbox 360, which is the second generation, and to try something else. So this entrepreneur-like opportunity really came at a perfect time, and I think everything kind of lined up for me, and I just was invited to be part of that team, and it was a great experience for me.
You know, what I find of interest, again, is this, you know, you talked about interpersonal skills, so you see that as a key component to be successful in the future.
I think interpersonal skills and communication skills are some of the most important skills, no matter which industry or your work function is, because for most business functions, you have to deal with people. I mean, even as a developer, you have to deal with maybe, you know, program managers and testers and then your upper chain of management. So you're always dealing with people. So I think the interpersonal skills and communication skills are really key to be successful in pretty much all fields and areas of work, I think. What do you think?
Well, there's this acronym called BATE, which is coming to the forefront, and that stands for having core business knowledge and core industry knowledge. Having a service-oriented attitude that is a focus on the user experience and the customer experience, and then also having strong interpersonal skills, which is linked into things like project management, customer relationship management, and communications capabilities, and then the technical competencies. And so those BATE attributes come together to allow for career growth. And it sounds like you've actually have all of those kinds of elements, and that's contributed to your success.
I think you're being very nice, Stephen. I think I have a little bit of everything, and I still think there's a lot for me to learn down the road. And I'm still learning every day, in fact.
Again, getting back to your China role, I just find it so fascinating. You know, what key lessons can you share from your experiences there?
Well, you know, Stephen, I can share with you a few points that I kind of gathered as I was living there. And I just want to make a note to all your listeners is that this is just my personal opinion. It doesn't reflect anything of my previous employers or anything at all. It's just my two cents. So I understand that, you know, just even living in two different cities could give you a very different view of the country as a whole. So I'm not going to try to pretend that, you know, I know all about China, but I'm just going to share a couple cents about, you know, what I noticed and, you know, what I think would be things that people might be interested to hear about. So the first thing I want to talk about is what most people have in mind is that China is really full of opportunity. You know, but one thing I want to say that is that all opportunities come at a cost. So I always see things and see people taking various compromises, you know, to be part of the China equation. And I think this holds true for many cases as well. And looking at China, I mean, you see on TV and all the time that there's incredible scale. I mean, it's really hard to imagine it when you're not really there. But once you're there, you just can't not notice it. So I like to talk about this little example. I'm not trying to kind of rank cities or anything like that, but just a little experience I had was we all heard about how Times Square in New York is great, it's bustling, it's big. It is. When I went there, it's a very busy and a very happening place, and there's a lot of scale in terms of buildings and people. And then I heard about, I went to Tokyo, and then I saw, the Ginza district, and it represented a different kind of scale in that it's not only skyscrapers, but it's also very dense. So that gave me a different sense of scale. But when I arrived at Shanghai, I was quite impressed and surprised at the same time because it seems like the whole city is made up of that scale, as opposed to having a few key areas that, might be a central business district or a shopping area. But a huge part of that whole city is consisted of that scale, and I just find that truly fascinating. There's growth everywhere. If you look at the sky, you see the sky cranes, and I heard this crazy, statistic saying that between China and Dubai, there's like 30% or half of the world's sky cranes. And there's always something under construction, something always really exciting, like, tallest building or whatnot. So, I think it's really fascinating for somebody just to even go there and take a look. And then just one aspect, just Shanghai. So I don't speak for all of China, but I speak from what I know. And, looking back at more day-to-day stuff, one would realize after living in North America for a long time, that the metropolitan areas are usually a little bit crowded, and, there's some pollution issues going on in major cities, and there's a certain kind of chaos that goes with a metropolitan of those sizes. So, these are things that I definitely picked up while I was there. Now, the one really interesting thing is that the major cities are really safe. And even walking in the streets, if you stay away from the, uber local areas, it's extremely safe. You can be walking in the middle of the night and still feel very safe. And I think that's something that not a lot of people know about, that they should. Now, looking at life there, in terms of business dealings and life, you also realize that everything is negotiable, and it's kind of to a T there. So there's a lot of gray areas because of the way a lot of the commerce is set up. You can negotiate everything from a meter taxi fare. There's a negotiation element to it, and I find that really fascinating. And help is cheap. If you live there, a lot of people actually have maids. Some people, quite a bit of people even have chauffeurs. So you can have a very high quality of living in terms of having people do things for you in China at a very affordable rate. And I think that's also, a big plus for busy people. Now, looking more into the demographic, one thing I noticed is that the younger people, notably Generation Y and beyond, they are very savvy. And they are very willing to spend to impress. If you go to the local shopping malls, the high-end, mid-end shopping malls, you see a lot of teenagers, early 20-year-olds, spending away with lots of bags toted in hand, new purchases, eating at upscale eateries. They're just very willing to spend, and I think they derive a lot of the incredible spending power from their rich parents, who have made their mark in business or whatnot in China. So I think that's a very interesting trend. And to follow from that, there were more top brand name stores in Shanghai and even when I'm in Beijing, but more so in Shanghai than I've ever seen anywhere before, anywhere else. It's really a heaven for people who like to, parties and have a nightlife and have excitement. But if you're raising a family there, you might have to weigh certain elements. And, that's how I felt, when I was living in China, and these are the observations I have. And just to close with a little bit of trivia in terms of how bustling and how busy that city really is, within a 1 kilometer radius of where I lived in Shanghai, there were at least 3 KFCs that I know of and at least 2 Pizza Huts. So, knowing how the density of those stores in North America, you can see, the level of business prosperity you have over there.
Sometimes people describe Shanghai as something like a neon city, where there's just these skyscrapers with huge sort of displays on the sides of the buildings and so forth. Did you see that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you can see it from both sides of the river. And it's just a city that never rests, basically. If you're out in the Bund area, which is across from the Pudong district, on both sides of the river, you will see neon signs, and they keep lit up for pretty much all night. And it just gives you this sense of aliveness, nightlife, and excitement that it's hard to find anywhere else.
Some people also say it's an expensive city. So let's say if there were some people in the audience who wanted to travel just to look at the opportunities there and stay for a few weeks, would you consider it too expensive or moderately expensive compared to New York or some of the other cities?
Compared to New York, you can still find a lot of less opulent but very affordable accommodations if you look hard enough, and even in a city like Shanghai. I mean, if you stick with the five-star accommodation, yes, it's got to be pretty much at par with New York if you stay in the city. But if you're not too concerned about that level of luxury, I still think there are a lot of options available in China or Shanghai or Beijing specifically, where you can expect to spend quite a bit less in accommodations if you forgo the luxury element. Now, with the airfare and the oil prices, standing high, there's going to be an additional element of the airfare, where it will be costing a lot more than before. And in fact, I started seeing that trend about a year and a half ago, that basically airfares have been steadily increasing, and the tickets are harder to come by because some airlines are also cutting their flight schedules just to keep their flights packed. So, I mean, in terms of accommodation once you're there in China, I think you'll find that to be a lot more affordable than New York because food costs less and transportation, everything costs a little bit less. So I think they all add up. So yeah, I still think China is very affordable to visit, and I think if you haven't been there, it should definitely be worth your while.
I guess there's the other aspect of just the economy itself. You know what, it's about a $3 trillion economy. There's a prediction that it'll be a $37 trillion economy, followed by the U.S. at $35 trillion, India at $27 trillion, and Japan will be fourth at $7 trillion. I just find those kinds of predictions amazing. And you have this growth rate of something like 11 to 12% per year. And this other prediction that by 2010, 90% of the world's engineers and scientists will be in India or in China or really the Asia region itself. Did you sort of get that feeling when you were there that there's just this huge growth and you can feel that growth?
I can certainly feel that growth. Since I'm in the technology industry, I can't speak for any other industry, but there is definitely a lot of enthusiasm within China. And I'm not just speaking about Shanghai, because during my stint as also highly involved with outsourcing in China, I get to see a lot of other cities. And it seems like that level of enthusiasm was contagious across all the cities that I visited, because technology is actually a very interesting and at the current point, rather lucrative industry. If you've not looked at the finance industry, which is kind of an industry on its own, but technology is still very accessible to a lot of the students doing university. They can just buy a computer and start learning about it and then getting savvy about it. So I think excitement, enthusiasm from within locally China, and also from people in other developed countries such as the United States, Canada, a lot of people are looking for opportunities to go back to China, and if you don't have to look far, you're already speaking with one right now. And all the friends who I talked to who knew that I went to China said, "Yeah, you know what? I really would like to have one of those opportunities." And to give you a really interesting piece of trivia as well, the person who, when I left Microsoft in China, the person who replaced me was a fellow classmate from Waterloo. So you can see that there's all this interest from all around the world who want to be part of the China equation and get a piece of the pie. So I definitely see that.
Because you have this sort of unique perspective of, being this world leader in essence of technology, and you've got patents and you're highly educated, and then you go into China to set up, the sort of venture that's associated with Microsoft in China, you have a really perfect position to talk about what you see as the areas of China technology leadership in the future. Can you comment on that?
Well, sure. First of all, I want to thank you a lot, Stephen, because you know you really painted an awesome picture of me, but still, I did glean a few key ideas that you know I want to share with your listeners in terms of what I personally think about technology leadership in China in the near future and maybe a little bit beyond. But I also want to say as a standard disclaimer that these are just my personal observations. So, you know, I don't represent Microsoft's opinion or so on. But I do have a few things I want to share. They're kind of, you know, scattered thoughts, so I'll try to make it as organized as possible. But one of the things, the first thing that I want to talk about is, you know, the role of expats and you know, foreigner workers in China. So the way I see it, the expat positions are working. In a nutshell, I really see them as the providers of necessary training and knowledge transfer to the local people. They're coming in to do a job that probably the locals are not ready to do, maybe because of their expertise or their specific experience with the company and the processes. So the key areas I see that are lacking in China right now, and once again, I only represent what I personally observe, and it's not a comprehensive list, are the international business etiquette. For example, you know, how do you deal with a multinational corporation during business negotiations? What are the typical terms that are encapsulated in these kind of deals that locals might not have any insight into? So it's all this existing knowledge about the etiquette and how business is done and the methodology that needs to be transferred to some local people so that they will have the knowledge, know-how, and experience to carry these out once the expatriates are gone or return to their own country. A second thing that I see is very much lacking, and this is from first-hand experience, is project management in technology. And you can extend that to a lot of forms of middle management in general, but the one factor I saw was project management. So one of the things that I had to do was to help train the project managers for some of the local outsourcing companies or provide value to them so that they could have a better idea of how to A, budget, B, schedule, and C, do ongoing management and reporting on all these projects. Because they are really the driving forces and interface points between the team in China and, you know, for our case, Redmond back in U.S. And, you know, so these are the areas that are really lacking. But one thing for sure is that they're really catching up quickly. And another thing a lot of people talk about, and especially when they talk about, you know, India versus China in the technology outsourcing arena, is that, well, you know, a lot of the local Chinese technology people, they don't speak fluent enough English. Now, mind you, most of them actually read and write very well because it's usually part of their learning curriculum. But in terms of spoken, there's still this kind of understanding that, you know, the IT or technology people in China might not be all very fluent English speakers. And a lot of people say that that's a problem. But for me, I actually look at it in a slightly different way, and you know, once again, this is my personal opinion, is that if you look at the Chinese language as a whole, you know, there's over, what, 1.3 billion, 1.4 billion people speaking the Chinese language, and, you know, it's pretty much at par more than the English-speaking population around. So I agree that the English-speaking skills right now at this juncture and for the near future will be extremely important for, you know, Chinese companies to effectively compete and be part of the global economy and business arena. And in fact, right now, people who are local in China who have English skills currently are very important, and they always command a premium. So you pay them more just because they can speak English well or you know, to an acceptable level. But as a personal opinion, I'm not sure how long this will remain the case, and, you know, whether it will be the case in the future. So that's one, you know, thinking point that maybe, you know, it's worth thinking over. Now, going back to the role of expats, I actually see that, you know, there will be some inevitable transition of leadership. Now, since I'm in technology, I'll just talk about technology. Is technology leadership back to the locals? Now, in talking about the locals, what I mean are a more diverse group that consists of and probably led by returnees from overseas and, you know, local people who have been studying and been growing up in China. So I've had the pleasure during the time I was in China to work with some extremely bright and hungry individuals. They learn extremely fast and they're very aggressive. So what I see in the near future and what I think will be a trend would be a lot of the locals, and once again they include the returnees from overseas, are penetrating into the executive level management positions and beyond in Chinese offices of foreign multinational companies, mostly through, you know, internal promotions, which I see a lot, because once the, you know, local people start moving up the chain, you know, they will want to promote people that have been working with them locally up to their positions. So I see that to be a trend in the future. And also, I mean, informally speaking, there will also be the buddy networks where, you know, once you're in a hiring position, you want to hire your friends and classmates and whatnot who you think are capable people into your organization to be part of your team. So I think a lot of that activity will create a lot of transition of leadership back to the locals and the returnees. Now, as a result of that, you know, one thing that follows is I think that perhaps the expat positions will become more and more rare in the future. And, you know, when the broad knowledge transfer is completed, you know, people will say that, hey, why do we need to pay so much for expats anymore? I mean, the local people now are kind of at least 80%, 90% up to speed. They understand the business processes and methodologies. And, you know, we really don't have to pay that much. So I think the level of expatriate jobs will decline, and the concept might even become less important than before. And, you know, all these previous jobs can be replaced by locals. And, I can even imagine a day where, you know, some foreigners will make less than locals just to get a ticket to play in the China arena. And in fact, if you look at the local fabric, you will actually be surprised that you'll see a lot of foreigners who are staying in China who are just, teaching English because they find China to be so fascinating and they want to be here and they want to be part of this excitement. So, I'm not talking down on, you know, expats or anything like that, but that's just something I noticed, and that might be something that will happen in the future. And the funny thing is, I didn't feel that much when I was back in North America. But the longer I stayed in China, the more I felt that will be a likely case. So, you know, that's something worth thinking about too, I guess. Now, talking about the technology leadership and how research and development will kind of become in the future, my personal feeling is that, you know, a lot of these returnees, the top Chinese talent, they're returning to China, and their talents were drawn from other countries as they come back to China to lead local companies. And, you know, very notably, the key areas of this happening is in research and development, software, hardware, and computing in general. And because of that, I actually expect to see some really formidable new homebrew technologies coming from China in the near future. And, you know, one really interesting thing about China is also that it has extremely high concentration of population in metropolitan areas, and a lot of the telecom infrastructure is actually very new and up to date. You know, in U.S. we have, U.S. and Canada, we have a lot of copper. You know, fiber to your curb is something that's really new and novel in the past few years. But if you look at China, a lot of the metropolitan areas have fiber by default. And, you know, they bring it all the way sometimes to the building basement, where it's distributed by copper. So with all this really high-speed, state-of-the-art infrastructure and the concentration of population, I think that will make China, some of the major cities of China, excellent testing grounds for new technology and communications and computing and also infrastructure. So, you know, that's pretty much, you know, a few key points that I have off the top of my head, and I hope that will add some value to your listeners.
Well, I understand that there's something like, more than 600 users of mobile phones now in China, and that's more than the next three or four countries combined.
Exactly.
And so do you have sort of a picture, and I hear that China Mobile, or no, sorry, I guess it was PetroChina, when they released another share offering, they became the first company to have a valuation of, over $1 trillion, right? Though that had dropped, I guess, subsequent to that. But you're probably seeing more and more of this. Prior to that, you have Excel Mobile or GE being in the top at something like, having a market cap of $300 billion, $350 billion, and then PetroChina just jumping over $1 trillion. Do you see that kind of trend happening with some China companies that are home brewed, but will start becoming global and will expand beyond that base? And because that environment is so competitive, the China environment is so competitive, it'll actually make them successful outside of China.
It's very interesting. I think the trend of China being a super hot buzzword will remain, and for how long, I don't know. I think there will continue to be huge offerings of that scale. I mean, as a personal opinion, just because that there is the demand and the business is there, and because of the population is so huge that can support that kind of business needs. Now, in terms of looking at the economy in general, I'm not an economist, but I also have my share of worries about, how long this growth can be sustained. I mean, at 11, 12%, as you mentioned, for a company that size is just crazy. And, how long can that sustain? And there's also a lot of hype around the upcoming Beijing Olympics. The real estate prices have gone high, both in, Beijing and Shanghai. And Shanghai has the World Expo in 2010. So there's a lot of excitement and hype. And, I'm not sure how much of that is rational and how much of that is not. But, to think that China can continue to grow at 11, 12% or more is just kind of mind-boggling and really something that's beyond me to comprehend. But that said, there's still the excitement. There's still a good amount of capital going around that's interested in either investing in China. Or another trend I saw was for China to invest out. One of it's a small tidbit, but it's also something I noticed when I was in China, is that a lot of the traditional real estate companies, that the core business is just real estate, who have made a phenomenal return in the last decade or so with the real estate boom, and they built up really big hoards of cash. But the problem is they have all their eggs in one basket. So what they were looking to do, I mean, these people, their core competency is in real estate. But what some of them I heard are looking at is to invest and actually diversify into foreign companies and also specifically technology. So I see a lot of this kind of new types of investment vehicles being created because of this new wealth, where a lot of the businesses that were not traditionally into investing overseas are looking at investing overseas just to diversify or maybe create liquidity in their assets once they convert it out from RMB to foreign currency. So there's a lot of exciting new developments and new ideas happening in China, and I certainly are positive about, new and bigger deals created. And but the thing is, I just don't know how long that would be sustainable at this rate.
Some of the interviews I conduct right now and with business and technology leaders, let's say out of the U.S., it's interesting that some of them are saying that in the regions that they live in, the second language that is being sort of highly touted amongst the school-age kids is actually Mandarin, because of this sort of whole idea of being able to connect with this huge country that's booming right now.
Yes, I agree with you. I, from most of the people I know and I hear about who are learning other languages, more and more I'm starting to hear that they're trying to pick up Mandarin. And if you just open up, your classifieds for, language learning, you'll see a lot more people offering to teach Mandarin. So I definitely think Mandarin is increasing up the value chain as being, the or one of the languages that you need to learn in order to stay competitive in the international business world.
I guess the other thing, I just want to go back to, I asked this question about technology leadership, and You indicated that you see some formidable new home brew technologies from China in the near future. Do you have any specifics in that area, or do you think it's too early to say at this point?
Well, I certainly don't know a lot about it, but a few areas, actually one key area I noticed is supercomputing. Because when I was in China, there was actually a team that's doing high-performance computing. And the reason they chose to be in the Shanghai area is because there are several universities. I don't have the names off the top of my head, but there are several key universities in that neighborhood, in that area, are actually home to a lot of the powerful supercomputers in China. So I think supercomputing and high-performance computing will be one of the key areas that I see, a lot of possible new developments and exciting technologies coming. And, there's also a lot of, language-related, probably like natural language processing, and some of the artificial vision that I've seen are quite exciting. So, these are a few examples I can quote based on what I've seen in my experiences, but I'm sure there'll be a lot more in terms of telecommunications and security and so on that will come out in the near future.
Well, Keith, I kind of see you as this new Gates or that kind of model, right? Because you're so innovative, you're a world leader already, and you're still quite young. Can you now share with us some of the stories surrounding the patented technologies you invented for Microsoft?
Sure. To talk about a couple patents, there are a few, but I might want to zero in on one or two because they're more relevant probably to your audience. And all of these are not personally held. Obviously, they are patents that I helped Microsoft acquire. And, I was also part of a team, maybe as small as two or three people and sometimes a bigger team. So it's not my personal patent, but I'm in it. One of the things that I'm really excited to talk about is a patent that relates to end-user extensible email. So what that really means is that it came from an idea and a business phenomenon, which is about 10 years ago. I don't know if you've heard of or you're aware of email servers. There's this email server called SendMail, which is an open source email server that's extremely flexible because you can modify whatever you want. And it was like a leader in email server and the sysadmin's choice back then as email servers because it's free, open source, you can do whatever you want with it. So in Microsoft, during that time, we also built a super relatively fast SMTP server, which delivers email using the SMTP protocol. And, our team wanted to challenge SendMail's dominance. Like, we just couldn't see that why this open source free email server will beat us, with all the enterprise support. So, a bunch of us looked at it and we realized that, okay, well, we can't do open source, obviously. So what's the next best weapon? So the next best weapon was basically, what if we don't let you rebuild the source code, but we give you pretty much as much flexibility as SendMail. Now, that's an interesting idea because, now you won't have to recompile and worry about building environments and all that mumbo-jumbo that, most corporations don't want to deal with. They don't want to have to recompile and build their own mail servers. So we went on that direction, and, after a few months, we designed an infrastructure that, basically allows the end user, and mind you, in that case, end user for servers are sysadmins. Right? They're not people like your mom and pop. So we want to give these sysadmins almost complete control of the mail delivery flow, and we want to give them total flexibility in creating extensions and modifying their server behavior. So what we did was we actually went on and built this thing. And it became a huge game because one good thing about not going open source is that everybody still runs the same base mail server. I mean, the binaries are the same. But they can plug in whatever they want, and they can have a lot of different places where they can plug in and modify behavior. So this common base mail server still allows Microsoft to provide customer support because the server itself is standardized, right? I mean, you just keep putting more plugins or building your own, but the base server is standardized, so we can provide support for that, and we don't have to worry about people changing it and causing all sorts of problems. So that was game number one, and I think that was a pretty cool thing. And what also happened was that it created a nice secondary market for email server extensions, and plugins. So people can actually, even create a small business out of just building these plugins and creating, customized mail server functionality for larger corporations. And in fact, that's, something that our consulting team does a lot too. So, what happened at the end is that we built a pilot for Bank of America, to do a custom authentication service for their internal mail servers. And, everything got validated and basically it shipped the year after that. So, it was written up and then applied and filed for a patent, and it was granted, I think, a couple of years ago. So I think that was one of the pretty exciting examples of how you can just take something as boring as email server, and kind of extend it and build a business need for it and build a competitive case and to, create something that's new. And at the end of the day, we think we created value for the end user because now we can actually provide support and standardized support for all these people who used to have to go into a debugger and debug their open source send mail and see what happened. So, that's one of the I think, a relatively interesting patents that, we came up with. And, to talk about another one, we can talk about, I was part of the Xbox launch team, so, I'm very closely involved with content delivery and content access. So we have another patent that we filed that's still pending. And it's basically, since it's a live protocol and still being used, I don't want to talk about it too much, but basically it's a proprietary protocol to manage secure and rights-managed distribution mechanism of content over a low-cost and insecure environment. So, that's another one of those that allowed us to shave a lot of costs by not having to rely on secure channels for the entire content access and distribution mechanism. So I'm sorry I can't talk a little bit more about it, but, I just want to share that with you because we thought it's pretty cool.
No, that sounds really interesting, and from my perspective anyways, it speaks to your innovation and your creativity and sort of this genius that you have. I want to now segue into this, the Xbox work itself, and specifically 360 work, and what lessons can you share from that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so before I go on to that, still, I want to mention once again, you give me a lot of credit, but it's still also a lot of teamwork that, resulted into the creativity and those ideas becoming a reality. So I can't emphasize enough how important teamwork it is. That plays a key part into the success of any type of project or venture, and it specifically ties into the Xbox 360. A lot of things had to happen, for it to really work out the way it did. It was one of the most successful console launches. The Xbox 1.0 is one of the most successful console launches, and, a lot of things have to happen to make it work, and teamwork is also one key part. Now, what else I gleaned from this experience, from the whole Xbox thing, is that, we all know that software startups are hard, but a software plus hardware startup, that's super hard. And, I wasn't at the top of that food chain, so a lot of things already have been, distilled away and then trickled down to me, but I still see a lot of challenges and things that were basically not happening the way that we planned to. Our vendors have slipped up. Samples came in that were not working or had major flaws. I mean, it's just, it could be a real nightmare. And I'm totally impressed by the team and everybody involved that, we all pulled together and got this to ship. Now, looking at that project and some of the other projects that I participated in, I there's some key ingredients for success that's kind of common to many of those projects, which are like good planning, smart and passionate people, and those people have to be empowered with autonomy to make to make certain decisions within their power, and a healthy war chest of money. It doesn't have to be in that particular order, but I think these are all pretty important for some huge undertaking like Xbox and Xbox 360. And I just feel that it's really impressive. And I've also found a few things about myself. A couple things about myself during that startup experience is I found out that I really love the adventure and excitement of startup efforts, and the incredibly fulfilling feeling of seeing something develop from a concept to a reality, I just think that sometimes anything that has great value and great returns will require the need of taking certain risks. And I think Microsoft has made a very wise choice by, taking this risk and entrusting in a bunch of people who thought they can build an online video game console and make it a very viable competitor to the PlayStation. So I mean, these are all great lessons that I kind of glean from working with that truly awesome group of people.
Okay, Keith, I just find this really quite interesting, this whole idea of risk and then, the disproportionate returns you can get from taking risk and going out and doing entrepreneurial ventures, I should say. Well, it's interesting that you've actually taken a major step in this direction and Parametric Ventures Incorporated. Can you tell more about this company that you founded?
Sure, Stephen. Well, Parametric Ventures is a company that I founded basically for the purpose of indulging my desire to convert some of my ideas into reality. And in doing so, I hope to do it in a profitable manner. So to talk about a little bit, just briefly, it's a company that's mainly focused on web-based projects. I like the web-based aspect because websites are extremely easy to access from people from around the world, and it's a perfect kind of a vehicle for me to reach a wide audience that's not limited in a particular geographical area. I like web-based projects that surround social media and how people interact with content or even interact with each other. I'm personally less interested in specific content or media types. For example, specific to images or video or news or RSS feeds. But I'm more interested in exploring different ways people can use and interact with the content to create value. Now, if you look at value from a business perspective, it's a pretty cut and dry term. Value essentially means ways of generating revenue or profit. But I want to look at it from a different point of view, which also includes the business aspect, but factoring in the social aspect. For example, if you look at Facebook, which is the incredibly popular social networking platform, they have extremely loyal users who come back, every day or every week at a high rate. And what you look at it is that it's, to the users of it, it's not creating value in terms of the business sense, in the sense that people using Facebook don't necessarily make money out of using it, but it fulfills one of their needs that either they need to reach out and interact with their friends or in a more passive way find out what their friends are doing, or even find ideas of what to do by exploring other groups, by making local contacts, or people share common interests. So that, to me, is value, right? Because it makes you feel happier. It kind of helps you do some of your day-to-day things with better ease and more resources and more choices. So I'm interested in social media in that sense, where it creates, whether it's monetary or tangible and intangible value to the end user.
So you're interested in then creating platforms for social networks and...
I'm actually interested in leveraging platforms to create social applications. So I look at it in a sense that, well, hey, for example, a Facebook application would be a perfect vehicle. It's web-based. It's leveraging a highly popular existing platform. And it also provides sort of a white canvas for me to put whatever I want inside it and create new ways for people to interact with others.
Okay, so you talked about Parametric Ventures Incorporated, and it's just really, really, I think, fascinating what you're doing in this area. And I see, I guess, TippyMonkey.com as sort of an outgrowth of this. Can you talk about this venture?
Oh, absolutely. It's already in beta, and it's been running for a while. TippingMonkey.com is, despite its funny name, it's really a finance and investing-related educational site that I built. It's a long story how I came to this idea, but it started as my days of being a multi-in options trader, making some side income, and I quickly realized that trading is not a scalable activity. What it means is that, there's some automated trading stuff going on, but most of the people who have to sit in front of a trading screen and, set their trades, set their price targets and so on, and you really have to be most of the time there to make money. And I realized that that doesn't scale. And being the techie that I am, I don't like things that don't scale because it means if I stop doing it, I don't make any money. So, you know, it started as an idea where, okay, how do I make trading scale? And obviously, you know, a lot of the new professionals are using automated trading algorithms where they define certain rules and say, okay, well, if this happens, I'm going to go in and trade in at this price, and if this happens, I'm going to get out. So I spent some time researching that, and, you know, I built something similar to that. And one thing I realized was, hey, if I share these picks with other people in the internet, and if they can give me feedback and maybe contribute to it, maybe I'll make a better system, and I'll make better trades. They pitch in some ideas, and they get to see the ideas, and they make better trades, and we all win. So it's kind of like this original win-win idea where I want to share these things, these ideas for free, which other sites charge money for, and, you know, try to get some feedback and build a better product based on the feedback. So it's kind of like a looped system. So Tipping Monkey was originally just a sharing site. As it evolved, I realized that I want to add an educational component to it. So I start really fleshing out what Tipping Monkey is. So what it is, you know, not to make it sound like a sales pitch, is that I want to provide a place for people to experiment with the stock market as a possible investment vehicle without using the real money. I mean, if you look at it now, well, you know, there's a lot of people doing it, and it's not really special. But where I think I differ is in the original premise and how I want to build the site, which I think are different from a lot of my competitors. So I want to build a site where users are not likely to outgrow it. So what I mean by that is that I want to build a site that is easy enough for beginners. It's friendly and easy enough for beginners to come in and learn the very basics of trading. Okay, how do I, you know, place an order to buy 10 shares of, you know, Microsoft or Google, for example, right? So this is the very basics. And it's kind of scary when you put some money in your account and now you're buying 10 shares of Microsoft. That's kind of scary. But if it's virtual money, you know, you can learn the basics pretty quickly. Now, beyond that, I don't want to end there because that's just the start of the journey. So I want to build more sophistication into it that as you get better, you will discover and then you can find further value. For example, let's say you're already a relatively successful stock trader. So what do you do now? I mean, you might want to go and learn some new techniques or experiment them. Like, okay, well, how do options work? Okay, well, if you go in and spend money on an options account and start trading, I mean, 99% you'll lose money. And that's stressful, and that hurts your confidence. So I built a platform that just goes beyond normal stock, and, you know, I allow them to explore more advanced, even advanced options trading strategies, such as spreads and straddles and so on. And beyond that, if you really grow beyond that and now you're a real guru, you're an individual trader and you're a guru, you make a lot of money, I even have a platform for you to run your own virtual hedge fund and showcase what you do to other people and teach them how to trade. So, you know, and so there's a tier of cascading sophistication that I want to build into this seemingly simple and silly site, where people actually can come in, they're not intimidated, and as they get better, they actually realize, hey, there's even more functionality. And I want to keep it in a way that it will keep you interested and you won't outgrow it and think it's trivial and, you know, and hopefully provide value back to the user. So, you know, but it's back to the basics. I mean, the key lesson I actually want every user to realize and learn and a question to ask themselves is, are you cut out for this stuff? You know, making money from the stock market is really, really hard. I mean, ask anyone who does that for a living or even trades on the side. It's hard. I mean, it's not easy to make money. And in fact, some statistics show that maybe like 70% of all independent traders, they don't make money in the long term. You know, so it's a hard thing, and you might have to lose a bunch of times before you can start making money. And the question I want everybody to ask is, are you cut out for this? Is this a good allocation of your time? So, you know, and it's great because a lot of people sign in, and within a month they blow up their portfolios because they heard some hotshot advice from, you know, their friend or over coffee, and then they went in and tried to trade it, and then they blow up their portfolios and lost, you know, 10, 50, 30, 100% of their portfolios. And that makes them realize that, hey, this is not easy. You know, there's some commitment required. So, I mean, the educational aspect is what I want to put into it. And, just to add on top of, what I'm trying to build, I also want to put in the social and collective intelligence element into the site. So basically, it's an experimentation on the crowd factor. So to do that, basically, I open up all the portfolios. So everybody can see what everyone else is trading, how they're doing, how they're ranked, and we just let every user decide who to follow, and they can find their own style through experimentation. So, I mean, just to wrap it up, essentially, I just want to provide ultimate value through direct or indirect education in the area of stock market investing.
Well, that's an interesting sort of platform that you created, and I'm going to have a look. And hey, try my hand at it too. So,
Sure, yeah, let me know what you think.
now in your current role, what do you see as your biggest challenges and their solutions? And again, how does this relate to business?
Yeah, it's a big change, to say the least, Stephen. I mean, going from, the very safe and relatively protected world of being in corporate, having all the perks and benefits, and to start out is a daunting task. And but I have to say that I'm enjoying every second of it. And it has opened a lot of doors and made me see things in a way that I would have never seen otherwise. So I really treasure that experience. Now, a lot of the challenges are pretty similar, but I'll talk about a couple that are currently most likely in the top of my list and that I want to share with everybody is running a consumer website. Growth is always a huge problem, right? How do you manage growth without the huge marketing budget that Microsoft or any major company has? It's everything is measured in page views and number of members and retention and frequency of visits, and that's how you get valued at the end of the day. So, growth is always one of the things on the top of my head, with respect to running this particular website. And the way I deal with it is that I make sure that I allocate enough resources for marketing, PR, sales. Meet up with the right people and get them really excited and enthusiastic about what you're doing. Convert them into believers and find cheap and hopefully free ways to get the word out there. I never underestimate the power of the word of mouth because after talking to a lot of people, that's the key element of viral marketing and viral success. So, that's something that everybody should really look into. And you should stay enthusiastic and passionate yourself about what you're doing because I mean the biggest dead giveaway is when you talk about what you're doing and you don't care and you have this flat tone and people won't believe in what you're doing because you got to project that level of confidence and belief in what you're doing. And I mean and just the smallest things can help. Maybe you can start and maintain a blog, just to keep your voice in the open so people can access you and access your thoughts and have a way to talk back to you and make contact. So, I mean, that's one of the things I'm looking at. It's always going to be on the top of anybody running a consumer website. Now, moving a little bit into the business side, so to speak, is, well, if you're running a small company, you're not cash rich. You have to worry about, watching your spending, then there's obvious burn rate management. Especially if you're a pre-profit company, I mean, you're burning resources faster than the way resources are coming in. So, another thing that's always on the top of my mind is keeping the burn rate under management and make sure that, you don't screw up and not have enough cash to really make the final push in terms of, marketing, PR, or, just hiring people. So, the way I just deal with it is I regard cash as king. Without cash, you really can't do anything. So, I invest a lot of time in planning and budgeting. And making sure that I stick with the plan, and the important thing is to review and revise them often enough to keep things current. And these are things I think about, just off the top of my head.
I thank you for those lessons. Again, because of the positioning that you have, can you provide your predictions of what you see as future IT and business trends and their implications and opportunities?
Yeah, well, there are a few things that I've been paying quite a bit of attention to recently, just because they're all over in the news and TV and the web, and it's touching the way we live our lives, right? So the first thing most of us will come across is the rising energy prices and food prices. And, you know, part of the reason of that is basically we're not generating enough to meet the demands, and it's also because of the demands are increasing, right? So I'm relatively interested in green technologies, you know, energy efficient solutions or ways to reduce the consumption of some of the traditional fossil-based energy. So, you know, I feel that this kind of impact will trickle through to the IT business. And one of the things that you might remember, we were at that Microsoft summit, they were talking about how idle servers are burning 70% of the power that's required to run them at 100%. And from, you know, having a few servers of my own, I know that a lot of my servers are not running at least 50% most of the time. So those servers are sitting there at half capacity and running at 70 or 80% of full load capacity, and that burns a lot of energy. And if you remember from that talk, you know, just to refresh you, is that those machines generate heat, and the data centers are paying an enormous amount in cooling bills just to keep the facility at operating temperature. So all these costs will cascade, and eventually all those costs will trickle to the people who rent or buy or maintain those servers. So I think that will be a big piece in IT spending, with energy prices increasing, amount of power available per server increasing, and the power consumption increasing per server, yet idle time not being improved. I think that will all roll into one big IT expenditure in terms of data center maintenance or just upkeeping your servers that you need to run your businesses. So I think, you know, more energy efficient solutions will be a key point in a lot of the IT business trends regarding the data center management and server maintenance. Now, to tie in with that, there's this really another really hot topic on server virtualization. I mean, I think it's a great idea. You know, you get one piece of hardware, and you run, you know, a certain amount of software instances or server instances on that one piece of hardware, and they all act as they're an independent server, but, you know, they share a lot of resources on the box. And I think that's one of the answers that will address the rising costs of data center and power consumption requirements for data centers, because now you can probably collapse, you know, three hardware servers into one piece of hardware and have them all running independently. And that reduces, you know, the energy requirement, increases utilization of each box, reduces the heat generated, and in turn reduces the cooling bill. So I think all of these would have to happen kind of in lockstep to reduce the basic consumption and, at the end of the day, the pricing that the end users are paying for those services. So that's one thought. And you know, to move on with there, I work in the social media space, right? So I look at social networking a lot. And, you know, I see a lot of prominent players coming up, like, you know, Facebook, Bebo, Open Social, and, you know, a number of others that are, you know, really garnering a lot of media attention and user base. And I see social networking being something that is here to stay. Specific brands might change. I mean, maybe in a few years a different company will come up and take the market. But I still see the concept staying around for a long time, because obviously, they are fulfilling a need for so many people to go on there, you know, on a very regular basis and spend time there, where our lives are essentially getting more and more busy. You know, we're spending more time at work, we're getting tethered to our smartphones and, you know, checking email all the time, and we're doing implicit work. And yet, we still find the time to go online to websites and just access the social network. And I think just that alone is enough to tell us that, you know, this concept is going to stay around. Who's going to own it, we don't know. What form it's going to take in the future, we're not sure. But it's a pretty fair bet to say that social networking is not dead, and there's a future for it. And, you know, since we mentioned the smartphones and Blackberries and all that, I see a natural progression for smartphones, you know, at least what we call smartphones, to replace traditional mobile phones. Because technology has advanced enough that you know, even though smartphones are still quite a bit more expensive to build than traditional mobile phones, more and more people, especially the younger generation, X, Y, and Z, they are more willing to spend an extra a premium to buy the latest phone or something that looks cool or something that provides additional value for them to maintain their social life. You know, and on top of that, things like BlackBerries that are targeted towards enterprise, it's just going to grow, you know, because people are getting more and more used to having email access 24/7, and I think that's not going to go away because in the workplace, you've got to be available to be competitive. So, you know, I see some sort of commoditization of smartphones, and another thing that needs to happen to make it a possibility is the to have more affordable and also the commoditization of unlimited data plans. Because if you have a smartphone and if you don't have an unlimited data plan, it's very easy for you to go over. You know, I recently saw a news report where somebody had to pay $600 in data fees just because they kept their BlackBerry on all the time and they were browsing without realizing that how much bandwidth they're using. And in the future, mobile content is just going to get richer and richer and richer. So, you know, by having a cap on the data you can access through your plan, it's just not going to work. So, I mean, these are a few things off the top of my head. It's more like a ramble than any structured thought, but, you know, I hope you get something out of that.
You know, as an entrepreneur, then, in terms of your predictions about trends, I see you sort of maybe indicating that there's an opportunity in green technologies or an opportunity in social networks or providing applications in the phone area, in the mobile area?
Yeah. I think, well, as an individual, it's harder to participate in green technologies, and because of the sheer cost of R&D and because there's lack of standards. One way to get involved with green technologies, as a lot of people have been saying, is just buy their stocks. But then it's a huge risk because there are no standards. You don't know who's going to be the front runner, and you might be wrong, and oftentimes being wrong means the company goes kaput. So, I mean, I'm more like an observer in the green technologies front, not just because I haven't found a good way to participate yet that carries less risk. But in terms of social networking and mobile services, I see them really converging. Because, I mean, there's not a day that you would go out, or I would go out, that I don't have my cell phone with me. I mean, I happen to have a relatively old smartphone, but, you know, I still go out with it every day. And in countries such as China or India, you know, they're bypassing the phase of, let me go back a little bit. In North America, the first computing device most people buy is the computer. And it's still that for now. I mean, it's going to change. But if you look at places like China and India, they're bypassing it. The first piece of computing technology they buy is usually a phone or a smartphone. So if you look at that, you know that there, at some point, if that's not already the case, I don't have the data, that there will be more smartphones than there will be computers, or at least phones that are equipped to browse the web. And because of that, more people will access their social networks or networks through those mobile devices. So I think the social networking idea, both for consumer and enterprise, and the commoditization of smartphones will go hand in hand. And I think the smartphone, in a certain way, shape, or form, will be the most popular computing devices that house the web browsers that access the social networks in the future. And yes, I definitely think there's an opportunity in social networks, though there's a huge upcoming market for applications for smartphones, especially tied into a rich user experience and productivity.
But I also see this sort of tie-in between social networks and your tippy monkey. You know, you have this sort of playing field, this platform where people can play and try things, and in essence, there's sort of like social intelligence about the stock market.
Oh, absolutely. It is clearly a social networking play as well. So, yes, that's why I believe in social networks, and I think mobile will also play a role in getting it spread even further.
You know, you have this really rich background, and I'd be interested in what do you see as the best sources for intelligence or resources, and why do you use them?
Well, I mean, for me, just like most other web denizens, you know, we rely on the web a lot for information. You know, definitions and things like that, you go to Wikipedia. You know, you have an abundance of search engines like, you know, Windows Live, Google, Yahoo, and whatnot that, you know, you can use to find and search for data and maps. But on top of using web as my main information acquisition tool, outside using traditional media, I mostly read periodicals to keep current because I find that, you know, to get, I just really sometimes prefer the smell of opening a magazine and flipping through the pages. It's just a little bit of old school, you know, habit that I have. So, you know, I read certain periodicals pretty religiously, like, you know, Harvard Business Review. It has some really good articles on, you know, business management, international business, and, you know, a lot of times the organizational behavior stuff, which is very interesting to me. You know, I also read other publications like Fortune, Inc., Fast Company, and so on. And I read some, you know, trading magazines, obviously. And, you know, and one, and also keep up to date with some of the books, you know, that are interesting to me. And one book that I'm reading lately is another one that I'm sure you have too, The CIO Leader. I'm also reading a book called Value at Risk, which is a method that's becoming more and more popular in evaluating risk-based returns, mostly used by banks, investment firms, and traders to evaluate, basically, to get this kind of return, how much money are you putting at risk, and what's the risk of losing it all. So it's a very intriguing but complicated area of study that I'm highly interested in, just because of my interest in investing. You know, and then another one I'm reading currently is a book called Investing in Brazilian Stocks. It's kind of strange, but the reason I'm reading is because the author of this book actually came onto my website, and he thought it was interesting, so he actually wrote me and offered to send me a pre-publication proof that I can review and talk about. So, you know, that's another book that I was reading about lately, and among other things.
You know, there's this, I think it's called the WebBot project, where they're sort of collecting intelligence from various sources, and they're you know, using this in some kind of a database, and they're mining that for trends from a business intelligence, from a stock intelligence, and so forth. Do you see TPMonkey being used in that way?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because I recently came across a term called the implicit web. I think I read it on from Always On, the daily emails from Always On Network, which is a venture network. They talk about being that, you know, as we spend more of our time online, searching for things we want, buying things that we actually want, we're leaving a lot of breadcrumbs of what we like, what we do, what our preferences, and, you know, what we like to look for in a lot of disjoint places. For example, you know, Google or whatnot probably has your search keyword history, and Amazon.com has your CD and book and DVD buying history. Wikipedia, if they store it, they probably know that, you know, which definitions you look up and, you know, which articles you read a lot. And there's a lot of these breadcrumbs out there in a very disjoint set of places. And if these data were combined, it would reveal a hell of a lot about you. And in fact, it might be revealing a lot more about you than you consciously know about, and therefore they call it the implicit web, which is, you know, the implicit heuristics about you, and that's a function of all the things you do online. So TPMonkey has its own set of analytical data that it gathers from its users, and most notably are the trading habits, trading sizes, the sectors that they like to invest in, and so on. And you know, there's a lot of analytics about each user if they choose to participate. And the good thing about it is it's open. So we're not just kind of keeping it to ourselves. We're actually opening up all the data. People can search for other members. They can look at what they're trading. In fact, we even tell you that people who bought, for example, Apple stock also bought these stocks, right? So it's a way for mutual discovery, if you will. You know, it's for people to discover other people who may or may not be similar or different in style, or they might have some common link to something you're looking for. And right there, they're a source of information for you. So, yeah, so my site collects a certain amount of information that will be useful both to us for our marketing and new feature planning purposes, and it will be useful for every user to find out more about people who are like them and, you know, make their choices based on how they perform or how they perceive of these people. So, yeah, I definitely agree with you that there's a lot of value into user-generated data in that sense.
You know, we're at the close of this interview, and I'm just going to provide an opportunity for you here. Is there any other comments or an area that you want to explore and just talk about for a few minutes before we end the interview?
Well, it's been a pretty long and comprehensive interview, and I really appreciate your patience for letting me just kind of rant on. I don't have anything specific in mind that I haven't covered or talked about already. Would you have any closing comments or questions for me?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. And again, Keith, I really appreciated you coming into this forum here to talk and share your insights. And we will continue to follow your significant contributions and your continued innovations and creativities and exploration into entrepreneurship. And we will read about you in the various publications. And we thank you for sharing your time and wisdom and insights with our audience.
Oh, it's been a most pleasant conversation with you, Stephen. You know, I hope this will be useful to your listeners, and I thank you for inviting me here today.